Good afternoon. I've just been invited to introduce Brian to you. I promise you'll be glad you came. You'll be able to say in future years, I was at the first seminar that Brian McLaren did at Greenbelt. I just thought I'd tell you a little bit about him so you know why we've asked him to come. Brian is now very well known, particularly in America, as a thinker, as a theologian. But in a previous life, he taught English at the University of Maryland, and he's gone on the record as saying that he believes that the church needs to listen to the artist and the poet as much as the theologian in terms of learning how to talk about God, how to express the truth about God. So I'm really, really glad Brian's here. He is a writer and a songwriter. I know we all are here at Greenbelt. But he's going to be sharing from experience and his absolute love of literature. So I give you Brian McLaren.
Good evening, everybody. Great to see you all. There was a moment in the movie Contact, Carl Sagan's movie, which has such an interesting story, as you know. Carl Sagan knew he was dying when the film was produced, based on a book that he'd written. And for many of us who saw it, we just felt that we were seeing in some ways Carl Sagan's last will and testament to humanity in that film. This man who had talked so much about science in the film decides to make the film about a kind of a romance between science and spirituality. And there's a moment in the film that's unforgettable. There's a young scientist who is ushered into a wormhole, travels through space, and suddenly is given a vision of some kind of celestial event. And as she's floating there in the weightlessness of space, in this little capsule, looking at this glorious celestial event, she says, "Indescribable. They should have sent a poet." They should have sent a poet becomes in many ways the theme of that movie. I think a lot of us would say that when it comes to the celestial event of God and the celestial event of Jesus Christ, something similar has happened in the Christian faith. We have lost that wonder and we've lost that sense of childlike awe. I think liberals, quote, lost it in one way. Conservatives lost it in another way. And we find ourselves wanting to have that kind of moment again where we can look at these glorious mysteries and have that sense they should have sent a poet. Blaise Pascal, really at the beginning of the modern era, epitomizes this. You know that Pascal was a great mathematician, a great philosopher. And you may have heard the story about what happened after he died. His personal assistant found in his heavy overcoat a piece of cloth sewn on the inside. And this piece of cloth had some words written in large capital letters, in other words, in small letters, that Pascal apparently had written and then kept literally over his heart, sewn into his coat. Never mentioned any of this to anyone, but this mysterious legacy was left after his death. And although Pascal, I'm sure, was not trying to write a poem, what he ended up writing was poetry. Probably the best poetry comes from people who aren't trying to write it, you know. But listen to what Pascal wrote. Memorial. In the year of grace, 1654, on Monday, 23rd of November, from about 10:30 in the evening until about 12:30, fire. God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of the philosophers and scholars. Certitude, certitude, feeling, joy, peace, God of Jesus Christ, thy God and my God, forgetfulness of the world and of everything except God. He is to be found only in the ways taught in the gospel. Greatness of the human soul. Righteous Father, the world has not known thee, but I have known thee. Joy, 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 tears of joy. I've separated myself from him. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. My God, wilt thou leave me? let me not be separated from him eternally. This is eternal life, that they may know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. Jesus Christ, capital letters, Jesus Christ. I have separated myself from him. I have fled from him, denied him, crucified him. Let me never be separated from him. We keep hold of him only by the way as taught in the gospel. Renunciation, total and sweet. Total submission to Jesus Christ and to my director. Eternally in joy for a day's training on earth. I will not forget thy word. I mean, if I can use this word, just an eruption of phrases expressing kind of a residue of this moment of very profound and intense mystical experience on the part of Pascal. Brilliant intellect. His pensées were fragments that he was collecting over his lifetime that he hoped one day to turn into an apologetic that would help convince increasingly skeptical, rationalistic Europeans that the gospel was true. Pensées were never finished. And here this fragment found in his coat, in some ways to me, is the greatest apologetic of all. Unintentional poetry, direct experience, conveyed with powerful intensity. I think one of the reasons why so many Christians today love C.S. Lewis is because although C.S. Lewis's poetry isn't considered his greatest work, even in his prose, he wrote like a poet. And at times, his writing had a quality that was somewhat visionary. Of all of his nonfiction, I think one of my very favorite sections comes at the end of his science fiction book, Perelandra. And if you've read that, you'll recall that this human character enters into something like a vision. And when Lewis himself describes this vision that this human character is having, you can't help but feel that this is reflecting a visionary experience of Lewis. And I have to admit that in my own experience, just reading this, I feel like I'm sort of on the borderline of visionary experience myself. But I'd like to just read you some fragments from this visionary description, written in prose, but very close to poetry. He's being informed by this angelic being, what he's seeing as he looks into this sky filled with glory. Each grain is at the center. The dust is at the center. The worlds are at the center. The beasts are at the center. The ancient peoples are there. The race that sinned is there. Where God is, there is the center. He is in every place. Not some of him in one place and some in another, but in each place, the whole God. Even in the smallness beyond thought, there is no way out of the center save into the bent will, which casts itself into the nowhere. In the plan of the great dance, plans without number interlock, and each movement becomes in its season the breaking into flower of the whole design, which all else has been directed. Thus, each is equally at the center, and none are there by being equals, but some by giving place, and some by receiving it, the small things by their smallness, and the great by their greatness, and all the patterns linked and looped together by the unions of a kneeling with a sceptered love. Blessed be he. All that is made seems planless to the darkened mind, because there are more plans. Set your eyes on one movement, and it will lead you through all the patterns, and it will seem to you the master movement, but the seeming will be true. Let no mouth open to gainsay it. There seems no plan because it is all plan. There seems no center because it is all center. The human thought he saw the great dance. It seemed to be woven out of the intertwining undulation of many cords or bands of light, leaping over and under one another, and mutually embraced in arabesques and flower-like subtleties. Each figure, as he looked at it, became the master figure or focus of the whole spectacle by means of which his eye disentangled all else and brought it into unity, only to be itself entangled when he looked to what he had taken for mere marginal decorations and found that there also the same hegemony was claimed, the claim made good, yet the former pattern not thereby dispossessed, but finding in its new subordination a significance greater than that which it had abdicated. He could see also, but the word seeing is now plainly inadequate. Wherever the ribbons or serpents of light intersected, minute corpuscles of momentary brightness, and he knew somehow that these were the secular generalities of which history tells, peoples, institutions, climates of opinion, civilizations, arts, sciences, and the like, ephemeral coruscations that piped their short song and vanished. One more paragraph. The whole solid figure of these enamored and interanimated circlings was suddenly revealed as the mere superficies of a far vaster pattern in four dimensions, and that figure was the boundary of yet others in other worlds, till suddenly, as the movement grew yet swifter, the intertwining yet more ecstatic, the relevance of all to all yet more intense, as dimension was added to dimension, and that part of him which could reason and remember was dropped farther and farther behind the part of him which saw. Even then, at the very zenith of complexity, complexity was eaten up and faded as a thin white cloud fades into the hard blue burning of the sky, and a simplicity beyond all comprehension, ancient and young as spring, illimitable, pellucid, drew him with the cords of infinite desire into its own stillness. He went up into such a quietness, a privacy, and a freshness that at the very moment when he stood farthest from our ordinary mode of being, he had the sense of stripping off encumbrances and awaking from a trance, coming to himself. Then his consciousness was engulfed. I don't know if you feel the power of that the way I do. But there's a phrase there that is so fascinating. For Lewis, who, like Pascal, has this reputation for sort of crystal clear logic, that Lewis says, the part of him which could reason and remember was dropped farther and farther behind the part of him which saw. Isn't it interesting that these two great minds, three great minds, Carl Sagan at the end of the modern era, Pascal at the beginning of it, and in many ways C.S. Lewis at kind of the pinnacle of it, these three great minds come to the edge of understanding, and then they realize that there's some mode of knowing. Lewis describes it as seeing, a word, by the way, that the Buddhists, I think, maybe know more about than the rest of us do. A seeing that proves to be the most valuable kind of seeing and knowing of all. And this is the knowledge that poets seek and that poets convey. And my sense, the farther along I go on the path of following Christ, my sense is that it's 100 times more important for my children as they grow up to understand, to get a feel for what C.S. Lewis is saying in those 6 or 8 paragraphs that I read, than it is for them to learn a whole long list of words with Latin roots, prefixes, and suffixes that are supposed to tell us about God. There's something that Lewis tapped into and something that Pascal tapped into and something that all the poets are seeking. An American theologian, Walter Brueggemann, describes it like this in a book he wrote called Finally Comes the Poet. His introduction is called Poetry in a Prose Flattened World. He says the gospel, of course, this is so much more true in America, I think, than it is here, but you'll understand. The gospel is a truth widely held, but a truth greatly reduced. It is a truth that has been flattened, trivialized, and rendered inane. Partly the gospel is simply an old habit among us, neither valued nor questioned. But more than that, our technical way of thinking reduces mystery to problem, transforms assurance to certitude, revises quality to quantity, and takes the categories of biblical faith and represents them in manageable shapes. There is then no danger, no energy, no possibility, no opening for newness. That means the gospel may have been twisted, pressed, tailored, and gerrymandered until it is comfortable with technological reason that leaves us unbothered and with ideology that leaves us with uncriticized. The task and possibility of preaching is to open out the good news of the gospel with alternative modes of speech. Speech that is dramatic, artistic, capable of inviting persons to join in another conversation, free of the reason of technique, unencumbered by ontologies that grow abstract, unembarrassed about concreteness. Such speech, when heard in freedom, assaults imagination and pushes out the presumed world in which most of us are trapped. Reduced speech leads to reduced lives. The church on Sunday morning, or whenever it engages in its odd speech, may be the last place in our society for imaginative speech that permits people to enter into new worlds of faith and to participate in joyous, obedient life. To address the issue of a truth greatly reduced requires us to be poets that speak against a prose world. The terms of that phrase are readily misunderstood. By prose, I refer to a world that is organized in a settled formula so that even pastoral prayers and love letters sound like memos. By poetry, I do not mean rhyme, rhythm, or meter, but language that moves us. Now, at this point, you have to pardon Walter Brueggemann because he uses a completely American image, but I think even though it's a foreign image, it'll work for you. Language that moves like Bob Gibson's fastball, that jumps at the right moment, that breaks open worlds with surprise, abrasion, and pace. Poetic speech is the only proclamation worth doing in a situation of reductionism. The only proclamation, I submit, that is worthy of the name preaching. Such preaching is not moral instruction or problem solving or doctrinal clarification. It is not good advice, nor is it romantic caressing, nor is it soothing good humor. It is rather steady, the ready, steady, surprising proposal that the real world into which God invites us to live is not the one made available by the rulers of this age. So Brueggemann is saying we live in a world flattened by prose, and that prose flattened world now has invaded the Christian community as well. And so that our sermons and our pastoral prayers are deemed good the more they resemble a business memo, the more they resemble a scientific formula, the more they have that same structure and organization that we want from that least poetic of all publications, the telephone book. Catholic theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar said it like this: God needs prophets in order to make himself known, and all prophets are necessarily artistic. What a prophet has to say can never be said in prose. And I know for me as a preacher, this hit me some years ago when I just started realizing how much of the Bible is poetry. I mean, we know the Psalms are poetry, and we know that in a certain sense, the wisdom literature has a poetic flavor. But when we start realizing that the prophets wrote in poetry as well, that almost all of the text of the prophets, major and minor, is in finely crafted poetry, that these guys are artists, not only artists with words, but also artists with deeds, using artistically nudity, excrement, profanity, all kinds of bizarre expressions. And one of the saddest things in the world is to take a modern Christian Bible commentary on the prophets and realize that these people are incapable of reading poetry Everything is read as prose. Genesis 1 is read as science. We should be nauseated by this, you see. It's pathetic. But this is the reduced approach to language that we have inherited in our culture at large. And in a way where we've tried to be relevant to culture, Brueggemann says, we've reduced our language and trivialized our message and made it inane. Another Roman Catholic, like Hans Urs von Balthasar, Romano Guardini, who was the chaplain to Pope John II of Vatican II, wrote this, I think, powerful paragraph. I think this paragraph should, it's beautiful, beautiful language. But in many ways, this paragraph gives me a better doctrine of the inspiration of Scripture than I could read in any prose theology text. Listen to this. When a human being in the grip of divine power attempts to convey something of God's holy otherness, he tries one earthly simile after another. In the end, he discards them all as inadequate and says apparently wild and senseless things meant to startle the heart into feeling what lies beyond the reaches of the brain. Something of this kind takes place here. Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man, what things God has prepared for those who love him. These realities beyond understanding can be brought closer only by the overthrow of everything naturally comprehensible. Flung into a world of new logic, we are forced to make an effort to understand. And I think what Guardini tells us there, if he's right, that to be in the grip of divine inspiration doesn't mean that you're suddenly given technical accuracy to reduce the mysteries of God into technical language, but instead you're thrown into the realm of the poet who grasps simile after simile and in the end says none of them work, you see, and throws them all away. It has to say apparently senseless things in order to startle us and grab our attention. If we could understand that, how different would our reading of a book like Revelation be? Try this, for those of you who are kind of Bible scholars. There's been a big debate in recent years between people who talk about the gospel of Jesus and the gospel about Jesus. Are you familiar with this? One way that the debate goes is to say the gospel of Jesus is the message Jesus preached. It was a message about love and compassion and justice, and it was about the loving and accepting heart of God. That was the gospel of Jesus. Then this line of reasoning goes, but then the Apostle Paul got a hold of it, and then he created the gospel about Jesus, and he was a Pharisee, and he sort of took the gospel of Jesus and perverted it into this gospel about guilt and exclusion, the very opposite of the gospel about Jesus. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard that kind of argument, but I'll bet a lot of us that sometimes have felt it, even if we don't want to accept it. But I'd like to offer you a different way of reading Paul. And for those of you who are familiar with the Paul's letter to the Romans, which is always held up as this high watermark of logical, rational argument, let me suggest to you, next time you read the book of Romans, maybe in the next couple days, give it a shot like this. Paul starts off in Romans doing this kind of reader response thing where he tricks people. He says, aren't those people over there really, really bad? Look at these terrible things they do. They're bad, they're bad, they're bad, they're bad. And right about the time where you start going, yeah, they're really bad, he says, but you're no better. You do all the same things. Wonderful case of reader response. The people who exegete Romans chapter 1 and never read Romans chapter 2, it's connected with it, you see, they end up saying the very opposite of what Paul wants to say. Aren't those people over there bad? His real goal is to say, aren't you the reader bad for judging them? Because you're no better, see? And then he starts grabbing metaphors. He reaches for the metaphor of propitiation. And he tries to explain propitiation. what we might call substitutionary atonement. And then he gets kind of done with that, and he says, boy, if you follow that line of thinking, you're going to say, well, maybe we should sin so that grace should abound. Well, that didn't work too well. And he reaches for another metaphor, and he takes Abraham and does something on a little motif on Abraham's life, and he takes that, works with it for a while. And then it's kind of like, boy, if you follow what I'm saying there, you're going to maybe go off. Okay, put that one aside. Let's try this. It's kind of like a marriage and a divorce deal, or it's kind of like being dead and then resurrected. Or it's kind of like, and he just grabs after simile after simile. And finally, he gets into this long thing about the Jews in chapters 9 and 10, and he gets to the end of chapter 11. See if when you read it, this doesn't work. He's trying to nail down this argument. He gets to the end, and he kind of throws up his hands, and he says, you know, who's known the mind of God? Who can counsel him? Basically saying, look, this is way beyond me. In this way, Paul's methodology is far more poetic than it is. It's a lot more like Jesus telling parables. Each parable gives a little glint of insight, a little glimmer of insight, but you never can see everything through one. One does its job. If you take it too far, it gets you into trouble. So he gives another one. That does another job. And so we have this idea of sort of flashes going off from all different perspectives that help bring light to something that we begin to get a three-dimensional picture of. Maybe Paul is far more the poet than we give him credit for. Well, having talked about this poetry, I think it's so foreign to us. We're so trained by other modes of discourse that it's a new skill for us to learn how to receive poetry and let poetry work on us. And maybe it would help us even to go back and reappraise the poetry of Scripture if we were to just immerse ourselves a little bit in some poetry from common life. And there is a tremendous resource in this regard, a living poet from the United States. He lives in the little state of Kentucky. A brilliant thinker and essayist, novelist, a deeply committed Christian, and also a wonderful poet. He has a collection of poems called A Timbered Choir. On Sundays, this poet, Wendell Berry, likes to make it a habit of taking a walk out in the land around his home. He lives out in the country. And as he takes a walk, he doesn't bring a pen or pencil. But as he takes a walk, he just notices, remember what C.S. Lewis said about a kind of seeing? Once the rationalization fades away, there's a kind of seeing. He just tries to see. And in the process of those walks, if a poem starts to emerge, he just lets it develop as he takes the walk. And then when he comes home, he'll write it down if it's good enough to stay with him. And this collection, A Timbered Choir, is these poems from about a 20-year period. I'd like to read one. Of course, poetry works best when it's heard, but so many of us are used to reading poems. But I'd like you to try to listen to this and let the language work. And I'll occasionally stop and make some comments about the poem. I don't know, with noise in the background and all the rest, it might not be the best environment for poetry. So I feel like I'm asking a lot of you, but you're here. So try to go here with me, all right? The frog, with lichened back and golden thigh, sits still, almost invisible on leafed and lichened stem. Invisibility, its sign of being at home, there in its given place, and well. Now, are you with me so far? He's picturing a frog. It's got a gray lichened back, and it's sitting on the bark of this tree, and it's almost invisible because it fits in there so well. Next stanza. The warbler, with its quivering striped throat, would live almost beyond my sight, almost beyond belief, but for its double note, among high leaves, a leaf, at ease, at home in air and light. So now he hears the two notes of a warbler, maybe a and just those notes let him know that a bird barely the size of a leaf is up there in the highest branches of the tree. Like that frog, it's at home, and being at home makes it almost invisible. And then he concludes, "And I, through woods and fields, through fallen days, am passing to where I belong, at home, at ease, and well, in Sabbaths of this place, almost invisible, to which I go from song to song." Beautiful moment of him realizing that as he passes through the forest, his invisibility is a sign of his being at home. I think he uses language in this powerful way. And it's a good poem at this time of year. As I was driving here today from Heathrow, you know, you look out and you see the fields now golden. All the hay has been cut. And the hay bales, the round and the square ones, are all there in the fields. And this is a poem about the end of summer. "The summer ends, and it is time to face another way. Our theme reversed. We harvest the last row to store against the cold. Undo the garden that will be undone. We grieve under the weakened sun to see all earth's green fountains dried and fallen all the works of light." So you're hearing his sadness. The sun seems weaker, although today that might not have been the case. And you see the plants now are starting to wilt, and many of them have been cut. And just as they went sowing seeds in the springtime, now they're sort of reversing the process and pulling things up out of the garden. And you have to fill this in, but his wife walks by him as he's there working in the garden. "You do not speak, and I regret this downfall of the good we sought as though the fault were mine. I bring the plow to turn the shattering leaves and bent stems into the dark from which they may return. At work, I see you leaving our bright land, the last cut flowers in your hand." The stillness of fall, the old stems being plowed under the soil, and his heart reaches out in love to his wife as she carries some flowers away from the field. And that sense of what's so fleeting, what slips through our fingers. I think there's always that sadness in the summer, isn't there? On the most beautiful summer day, you're just so aware that summer is so short, you know, and all the pleasures of summer, the older you get, the more this is true, are so fleeting. And yet there's this sense, the one little glimmer of continuance is the love that you feel in just those few lines addressed to his wife. Wendell Berry writes a lot about death. And in this next poem, he describes coming to a scene where, and maybe you've had this happen, where there used to be some big, beautiful trees that he had become accustomed to over the years, and those trees have now been cut down. And when he sees that vacant place where those trees used to be, he thinks about people that he knows who've also died and disappeared, and this gets him reflecting on mortality and life. And listen to this beautiful poem. "Not again in this flesh will I see the old trees stand here as they did, weighty creatures made of light, delight, of their making straight in them and well, whatever blight or blindness was or made, however thought or act might fail." By the way, that's just that image that trees are made of light, you see, stretches our normal way of thinking. It reminds us it really is true. It's light that helps make a tree. And he goes on, "The burden of absence grows, and I pay daily the grief I owe to love for women and men, days and trees I will not know again. Pray for the world's light thus borne away. Pray for the little songs that wake and move. For comfort as these lights depart, recall again the angels of the thicket, columbine, aerial in the whelming tangle, song drifting down, light rain, day returning in song, the lordly art piercing out its humble way. Though blindness may yet detonate in light, ruining all after all these years, great right subsumed at last in paltry wrong, what do we know? Still that presence that we come into with song is here, shaping the seasons of his wild will. And so in looking at a tangle of vines and flowers and of looking at where some trees once stood and thinking of the glory that was there in those living trees, finally, Wendell Berry says, the presence that we come into with song is here. God's presence is here, shaping the seasons of his wild will. And with the comings and goings and the deaths and absence, he still senses some wild will of God at work. Well, when I hear language used in this way, it feels to me so different from the way that we use language in the world of faith today. A friend of mine, Tom Willett, was writing about the contemporary Christian music scene, and he has a way with words. Contemporary Christian music is a pop music subgenre so rich in wishful thinking and muddled intentions as to suggest the burlesque. Its aesthetic shortcomings and spiritual deficiencies being too obvious and saddening to enumerate. In the bright days of the Jesus movement, the idea of creating a musical format to give voice to a generation's experience of spiritual revival made complete sense. Yet the 2020 vision of hindsight suggests that shortly after the first blush of the Jesus music began to wear off, many believing musicians, like their non-musical counterparts, should have moved on to the deeper things of life in Christ. As artist producer T-Bone Burnett famously put it at the time, and you might know T-Bone Burnett from Brother Where Art Thou, he was the musical director for that. T-Bone Burnett said, many musicians have seen the light. The question for each of us is whether to write songs about the light or about what one sees by the light. See? And I think what Tom is suggesting to us there is that if we think that to do Christian music or Christian art means that we always have to be describing the light, after a while, that's going to get pretty boring. The purpose of light is to help you see other things, and a very wonderful act of faith then is to describe what you see by the light. He goes on, instead of responding to the natural dynamics of spiritual and creative growth, where the pursuit of Christ leads to an ever-deepening penetration of the Spirit into our everyday humanness, and the pursuit of beauty leads to an ever-widening creative engagement with the world around us, the movement calcified into an industry whose hallmark became a nostalgic recycling of once vibrant faith, tragically debilitated by infantile paralysis. I don't know if that makes you groan, but to me this so well describes our dilemma. A friend of mine, well-known musician, I can't quote him exactly on this. Maybe I could, but I probably better not. Well-known musician in the States, David Wilcox. Somebody asked him about Christian music, and he said, they got the greatest subject in the world. Why is their music so, and I won't fill in the blank. You could fill it in however you want. But you see, this is our challenge, I think. When we start getting bored with the way we're talking about God, it might be time to shut up and start talking about God's world and the things God's made from the light God has given us. And it might be time to shut up until we feel that we can talk about God in fresh and reverent ways again. You know, the prophets come and go. There's periods where the prophets are pretty quiet. And sometimes I think we have to let there be a little latency of silence so that we can hear afresh again. Novelist Walker Percy said that if you keep going around shouting the gospel, you know, Jesus, Jesus, grace, grace, pretty soon it can sound like you're shouting Exxon, Exxon, you know, McDonald's, McDonald's. And it all becomes a slogan. And so how do we become people more sensitized to the power of poetry again and the power of words again? Well, let me make a couple of suggestions that perhaps a part of your spiritual discipline, part of your theological study, should be to sensitize your heart to poetry in other genres or in other areas so that when you open the Bible, you'll have a feel for how poetry works. You see, for people in the ancient world who were the first receivers of Scripture, they weren't print people. There was no print. Many of them were illiterate. They were oral culture people. And that's where poetry is so important. Poetry involves distilling down to memorable words that you don't have to write down, but that stay with you simply by their rhythm and by their beauty and their freshness. And the words carry on generation by generation. I sometimes do a little game with people. We could take movies of the last 20 years that everybody has seen. Like, I don't know, do we have any Dumb and Dumber fans here? You know, you could take Dumb and Dumber, or do we have any fans of The Princess Bride? I'm sort of a stupid movie fan, you know, or The Wizard of Oz. You know, you can take, for people who've seen these films, you take a line, you give the first two words, you say it, and everybody else can repeat it in unison, you see? Well, that's how poetry worked for pre-literate people. That was the language that everybody knew. You didn't sit around at night watching television, but you sat around at night hearing the poetry that had been passed on generation to generation. And so we sensitize ourselves to the ways language works. Can I say it this way? If you never spoke English anywhere and you never read English anywhere else, when you'd pick up the Bible, you couldn't read it here. The value of the Bible depends on your literacy outside the Bible. And to appreciate the poetry of Scripture, maybe we need to learn to sensitize our hearts to how poetry works other places in life. I'd also encourage you to try to stop reading the Bible as a prose work, but read it as a poetic work. You know, again, Paul is so often preached as if he's this logical guy. His sentence structure is bizarre sometimes. But Paul loves images, and he's far more poetic than we often realize. And to let Paul work as a poet the way we let Jesus work and David work and Jeremiah and Isaiah and Joel and Amos and Habakkuk and all the rest work, I think that'll help us to get a fresh look at what God. I think also we should be saddened by the preachers and theologians who reduce the truth about God to prose, who feel that the best statements that can be made about God are abstractions and propositions. I think you should pray for those people, and I think you should beg them. I really think beg is the right word. I think you should beg them to find some poetry. With a tear in your eye, beg them to find poetry. And if they can't or if they won't, please don't bother them. Because Pascal, you know, it was after that night in November when he would have understood what you're talking about. And maybe some of them just need that kind of a night in November to come for them. And probably many of them will do a good job of taking care of a passing generation who has been so downtrodden by prose to believe that there's nothing better than prose. But brothers and sisters, for my friends, we need people who learn how to find the poetry in the gospel. We need people who understand that faith and imagination are two sides of one coin, that faith and imagination go so strongly hand in hand that to lose one is to lose the other. I mentioned that C.S. Lewis isn't well known for his poetry, and when I read you this poem, you may understand why. This is not an easy poem, but I think this is one of the most fascinating things to come out of C.S. Lewis's pen, and it's a poem that conveys some very profound theology. I'm going to have to explicate it at a couple points because it's... Lewis called this poem a footnote to all prayers. The one whom I bow to only knows to whom I bow when I attempt the ineffable name, murmuring thou. Are you with me there? When I bow to the one, he's the only one who knows who I'm bowing to when I use that name thou. And dream of Phaedian fancies and embrace in heart symbols I know which cannot be the thing thou art. Now, this phrase Phaedian fancies is a reference to a Greek historic person named Phaedius, who's a fascinating fellow in history. He was the idol maker of classical Greece. In fact, a couple of his great, huge statues of gods, I understand they were stories tall. You know, people would travel from all over the Mediterranean world to see these gods made by Phaedius. And the interesting thing about Phaedius is his renown carried on through history. But his works, none of them exist. They were all destroyed. But here was this man in classical Greek era whose dream was to create statues. We'd probably call them idols, but statues of the Greek gods that so inspired people. And so what Lewis says is, the one whom I bow to only knows to whom I bow when I attempt the ineffable name, murmuring thou, and dream of Phaedian fancies and embrace in heart symbols I know which cannot be the thing thou art. And so he says, every time I pray, I'm like Phaedius. I'm trying to construct an image of you to talk to. And I use symbols for you. Symbols, I realize they aren't what you really are, but I confuse the symbols with reality. Let me just pause here to say, this is one of our great challenges in the Christian faith, because our theological systems of the last few centuries have done something to many of us. I'm sure not all of us, but I bet to many of us this is true. They have taken one of the symbols, our metaphors, to talk about God. And somehow we've been convinced that this metaphor is not a metaphor, it's reality, and it's the most primal reality. And then we become convinced that all the other things are metaphors sort of orbiting around this central reality. And that's the metaphor of God as judge. Now, we don't even realize that that's a metaphor. God wasn't a judge before there were judges. I mean, you can't call God a judge when nothing like a judge exists. And let's say judges come into existence somewhere between 2000 and 1500 BC in the ancient world. Well, only then can you ever start using that metaphor to even talk about God. And the idea of what a judge is and does through history has changed radically. So for you to think of God as being like a judge, and for someone in 1400 BC to think about God as being like a judge, they're two very different things, even though you... The same really applies to talking about God as king. It's almost impossible to use the word king today to talk about God without evoking the Middle Ages and without evoking a sort of quaintness. And when people used the word king in Jesus' time, that was not the case. It wasn't quaint. It was present reality, you see. So C.S. Lewis is saying, I use these symbols and I mix them up and I think the symbol is reality somehow. And I've got to clear my head from this, he says. Thus always, taken at their word, all prayers blaspheme, worshiping with frail images of folklore dream, and all in their praying, self-deceived, address the coinage of their own unquiet thoughts. Unless, now I'll come back to the unless in a minute, but you understand what he's saying? If God were to take us at our word, if God could sort of unscrew the cranium, you know, and look inside our brain and see what images we really had in our minds when we prayed, when we use words even like Father and King and God and all the rest. C.S. Lewis is saying every one of those images in our mind is a blasphemy if God took us at our word. All in their praying, self-deceived, address the coinage of their own unquiet thoughts, unless thou in thy magnetic mercy to thyself divert our arrows, aimed unskillfully beyond desert. So he says it's like we're shooting these arrows and we're missing the mark, but unless you magnetize them and make them come to you by grace, you know, we don't know what we're talking about. And all our idolaters crying unheard to a deaf idol, if thou take them at their word, Take not, O Lord, our literal sense. Lord, in thy great unspoken speech, our limping metaphor. In a sense, the greatest work of the poet is to use a few words to take you to a place where you don't need words anymore and where you feel that words just fall short. And as we seek to talk about unspeakable mysteries, unimaginable glory, I would hope that we could learn to see that the scriptures had it right. The greatest theologians are poets. And the poets, incredibly important theologians. Let me make just one or two closing comments, and I wouldn't mind taking a question or two. We'll have a few extra minutes if anyone wanted to ask. But a festival like this, where there are a lot of artistic people, and especially there are a lot of people I know interested in music, in the church, we desperately need poets to write lyrics for worship songs that don't feel like nostalgia. What did Tom Willett say? Infantile, spiritual infantile paralysis, you know. We need poets who will take us deep, and poets will use fresh language. I was speaking at a worship leaders event several months ago, and afterwards, a well-known worship leader came up to me and said, "Wow, your talk really made me think." He said, "I got the idea that you feel that the Bible should actually inspire us to do our own creativity." He said, "I always thought to do worship songs, you just had to take phrases out of the Bible and weave them together." And my heart just sank. You know, I just thought, well, I was glad that he got some new idea. But you see, this idea that our creativity, our own creativity, is somehow that the Bible is supposed to be the ceiling under which we aren't allowed to, above which we can't rise, instead of the runway from which we take off, to keep the conversation about God going, to keep the poets inspired, to hear the conversation that's happened in the past so that the poets of today can seek to find that kind of language. Well, I just hope that maybe one outcome of this is that maybe many of us here in this place would take up the challenge of becoming those kind of poets for a new era and a new day. And those of you who do write real poetry, one of the great gifts of poetry is that it slows people down. You can't speed read it. And in a world where we're all so rushed, and where being rushed is probably it's probably the devil that we all welcome into our lives, you know. In that kind of a world, people who can speak in a way that helps slow our thinking down, they have a wonderful gift that we all need, and I hope you'll find some encouragement from this time. Time's up? Okay.
If anyone has a question, if you'd just like to stand up and wave your hand, we have a roving mic. So if you have a question, stand up and wave, and we'll know where you are.
I just heard a speaker say that any art which has a message intended in it is bad art. I just wondered if you'd like to respond to that.
Well, you know, I think you often hear that that's almost a poetic kind of statement in itself, because remember how the poet says wild and senseless things. I mean, there's certain sense that that's senseless, because if an artist isn't trying to say something, if there isn't a message, I'm not sure why he would speak. But on the other hand, it makes sense why someone would say that, because what there's a fine line between art and propaganda. And I think when we say, I have a message and I'd like to encode it and be clever with it and package it in some kind of way, and we try to say that's art, I think it really feels like propaganda. A Christian novelist who died maybe 20 years ago, an American named Walker Percy, was an interesting fellow in this regard. He studied to be a medical doctor, and he contracted pulmonary tuberculosis from a cadaver while he was in medical school, kind of a gruesome thought. And he almost died of tuberculosis, but while he was convalescing is when he started doing some reading, started with Sartre and Camus. They kept mentioning this guy Kierkegaard. You don't meet too many people who were converted to Christian faith through Kierkegaard, but he was one. Then read the whole Summa Theologica by Thomas Aquinas, another fascinating combination. But Walker Percy used to say that when he wrote a novel, he had no outline, he had no plan for where he was going. He started with a character in a predicament, and he started writing to find out how the character would get out of the predicament. And I think what Percy was saying there is that the act of writing the novel, the artistic pursuit, was a discovery process. So instead of starting with a message, he discovered his message as he was pursuing it. My guess is that's often how it works for poets. So Wendell Berry is standing, and where there used to be a couple of big, beautiful old trees, and now the trees have been sawn down, and he feels something at that absence. I know I felt this. I bet you have too, where there's just a hole in the sky where there used to be a tree, and that absence makes him feel something. And he ruminates on that and starts to write about it. And, you know, he's probably not totally sure what his message is when he finishes the poem. And as we read it, we then enter into it with him, and we start exploring how absence works in our lives. And maybe that shared discovery, which flows from the language not being so perfectly complete, you see, is part of the magic of the whole artistic process and the magic of poetry, which is why when we demand that our sermons tie everything up or our theologies give these perfect little answers, you realize how the Bible, which is such a mess, I mean, it's just a mess of loose ends, you see? It's why theologians have to domesticate it so much. But the Bible itself has this quality that invites you into it to be part of the struggle. So I hope that's helpful. Maybe time for one more if someone else had a question or comment.
I just was thinking, if we keep hold of the poetic quality, this expressive artistic quality that's inherent in the gospel that you've been saying, then how exactly do you relate it to people who don't think that way, scientists, logical thinkers, and people like that?
A great question. First of all, I would say it's probably the scientists and logical thinkers very often are the ones who really do appreciate the poetry, because I think there are so many great quotes about this sort of thing from Einstein and Max Planck and Niels Bohr and Edwin Hubble and others that the scientists see a certain kind of pattern in nature that becomes to them a kind of rhythm and a kind of poetry in and of itself. But you're right. There are a lot of people who don't seem to appreciate the poetic. And, you know, thank God there are plenty of people who are good at communicating to them. I mean, look, Four Spiritual Laws, do you all ever see that over here, that little booklet? That helps a lot of people. It's the very antithesis of poetry, but it helps a lot of people. So thank God that it helps those people. But I just think one of the problems is if you hang around Jesus very long, he forces you to have to start working with poetry. I mean, his parables have that kind of artistic quality that engage the imagination and draw you in. And if any, maybe you could say it this way, they trick you into thinking in some new and seeing in some new and fresh ways. Well, thank you very much. I'll be glad to stick around if anyone wants to chat, but it's a pleasure. Thank you.